From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in a public park in San Antonio, Texas. A man in workout gear was greeting the joggers and walkers and asking them a question. Got a minute to chat? That man is Anthony Magnabosco. And Connections listeners, he is one of the very best interviewers alive today. I'm serious. If I have improved my skills as a talk show host at all, it is at least in part thanks to people like Anthony. I have watched dozens of his videos in which he has courteous, careful, thoughtful conversations with people who do want to engage. So what are they talking about in these videos? Well, it's up to them, really. Anthony's goal is to encourage people to examine the foundations of their own beliefs. He is not out explicitly to change minds or convince people they're wrong or admit it. He wants them to draw their own conclusions in their own time. They talk about belief in God or miracles. They talk about magic or aliens or just about any belief someone can hold. Anthony wants all of us to ask ourselves, do I have sound, reliable reasons for believing what I believe? And if not, can I let certain beliefs go? His technique is known as street epistemology. If you've ever struggled in a debate with a family member or a friend who voted for someone you just can't believe it, or a relative at Thanksgiving and it feels like no one will give an inch, I've been there. We're not saying this hour you're going to learn to win those arguments. Instead, I think Anthony's going to help us do things a little better. I asked him to come on Connections to talk technique and to help all of us examine our own beliefs and the reasons we have, reliable or not. Anthony Magnabosco is the Executive Director of Street Epistemology International. How are you, sir?
Evan, I'm doing great. Thank you so much. What an incredible introduction. My goodness.
Yeah, you can.
That was fantastic. Thank you.
Put that on your resume, man. There you go. How's that?
It's really incredible. Yeah, it's really an honor to be here to talk to you and your audience about street epistemology. I think it's an incredibly useful tool for people who are frustrated with arguing with people and making no progress. So thank you so much for having me on your show.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the background first, and then we're going to kind of get into it. And listeners, as we go throughout this hour, I want to sort of open it up and let people, if you want to call in and sort of have your own sort of street epistemology session with Anthony, you can do that. If you've got a belief and people challenge you, or you're struggling with something, or you're asking yourself about your beliefs, or if you've changed your mind about something, I would love to hear from people who have changed their mind about big things. We're going to open it up to everything as we go throughout the hour. Anthony, I first heard about you when I had dinner with my friend Peter Bell, who is one of the really smart people in the Finger Lakes region. And so he mentions the work that you were doing. I had known about Peter Boghossian's book, and so I jumped on to watch your videos, and I'm probably like a lot of people. The first time I watch your videos, I'm thinking, this is kind of weird. You know, you're in like this public setting, and you're just walking up to strangers. But it quickly became obvious that people do like to engage. They like it as long as it's sort of courteous. Tell me about how you got to doing what you're doing.
That's been my impression as well. I think most people, once they get past the initial awkwardness of explaining to somebody a belief that they hold dear, that they think is true, that they're willing to explore with you and perhaps let you film it, the conversations tend to go really well to the point where people like to come back or send their friends to have conversations too. But I think it's pretty important to mention that those who do street epistemology, which you've explained very well, and I'm sure we'll get into it further, you don't have to initiate talks with strangers on the street like you'll see in the videos. But in order for me to practice it and teach people how to do it, it seemed like a necessary thing. So it is a little awkward to see somebody starting a conversation with a stranger. But for the most part, people will be using this with family and friends to challenge all different kinds of beliefs. And I can go further into that if you'd like.
Well, how do you describe or define street epistemology in a short sense?
Yeah, it's a very intimidating word, I think, epistemology, which is the study of knowledge. Now, street epistemology is an extremely informal, friendly, straight to the point, how can we explore your claim by me using questions and then giving you something to think about so that you can process it on your own and maybe we can meet later. That's typically what it is. It's counterintuitive as well. Typically, when we run into somebody who we disagree with or we think that they're just so wrong, how could we help them? We tend to argue with people, give them evidence that shows that they're mistaken. And that act could actually cause a person to double down even more on their beliefs. So what we're finding with street epistemology is when you use questions to elicit responses from your conversation partner, and you try to approach it as, how can we review the steps that you use to arrive at your conclusion? Not give me reasons to convince me to believe what you believe, but take me through your steps. How did you arrive at your conclusion? And that's a big shift with what we typically see when we watch engagements with people on social media or elsewhere.
I'd like to listen to a clip, if we could, from one of the videos. And again, on YouTube and through Street Epistemology International, you can find these conversations. They are fascinating to watch. As Anthony mentions, a lot of people, once they kind of get comfortable, they seem to enjoy it. They enjoy the give and take, and it's a really interesting process to watch. And in the clip that we have, I think the woman's name was Emily. So she's talking about her belief in God and the absolute certainty she has that her faith is correct, that the God she believes in is the one true God, that Jesus died for her sins. And at one point you ask her, you know, to envision a scenario in which there's a guy on a path in a park and there's a woman out for a jog and they're having a conversation and she's talking about her beliefs, but they're in India. And the conversation is much the same as you're having with her, but the woman in India believes in a different God. And you're asking Emily at that point, you know, how would somebody kind of evaluate which one of you is right? Because you both claim to have 100% certainty, not even a little bit of doubt. And I want to listen to how this part of the conversation went. Let's go ahead.
What would you say to a person like that who's using all the same processes that you're using, but concluding that a completely different God is real?
I think that I would ask her about her God. I would want to get to know her personally and get to know her story and her heart. And
do you think that she would say that her God was real and maybe even more real than yours?
She very well might. But I think I would ask her just to tell me about her God. What is he like? Mm-hmm. How does he influence your life? And how does having a relationship with him, what does that look like played out in your life?
Sure.
And for me, like with having a relationship with Jesus, that's looked like him dying for my sins, and so I'm forgiven and I'm set free, and I am able to be brought to God because Jesus says that he's the way, the truth, and the life, and that no one comes to the Father except through Jesus. Mm-hmm. And so because of that, like I have been set free, and so I'm able to live in freedom. And there's a lot of other religions, and I'm not briefed in lots of other religions where there's not
same
a lot
here.
Of
I'm not really an expert here.
Yeah.
Yet this woman would probably be able to find passages in her holy book that mm-hmm. would justify her certainty that she had it right.
Yeah.
How could a neutral observer looking at both of those, your situation and hers, mm-hmm. maybe somebody even like myself mm-hmm. that wanted to figure out which of the two of you really had it right.
Yeah.
How could we test both claims to see who was really believing in the correct deity?
Well, I think that's part of faith is like when it's all said and done, we're going to find out. You know, I believe that when we die, this isn't it. We're either, you know, we're eternal beings.
Can we find it out in this life?
If we're eternal or not?
Can we find out whether this hypothesis that you have, mm-hmm. is true in this life?
Because I found it to be true.
Yeah, because if it's not and we die, we'd really have no way of reporting back to the other people who are believing this stuff that, hey, hold on a second, there's an issue here. So how could we figure out in this life that what you're believing in is true? Is faith the thing that you need?
I think that's been the thing for me, is placing my faith in Jesus and just the experience that I've had in response to that.
Mm-hmm.
So the reason I chose
that
section, Anthony, is because I want to hear from you what's going through your mind when you're guiding that discussion. When you ask, well, how would a neutral observer be able to take your claim that Jesus died for your sins and the claims of a woman in India who is 100% certain that a different religious framework is correct. Mm-hmm. What are you sort of working toward in that moment?
Well, it's really important to be very, well, it seems like being calm and focused during these talks lends itself really well to this approach. Now, what we were doing there And you probably noticed it. It was calm. We were relaxed. We weren't yelling at each other. I was maybe even repeating back some things that I heard or acknowledging with a soothing tone that I've heard something. But in essence, what you were listening to there is something that we refer to as the outsider test for faith. Or do you, are you willing to set aside your own biases that you might have for your own view and apply those same reasons to a completely different conclusion? Or can we look at somebody who maybe has used the same methods that you're using or giving similar reasons, but they're arriving at a different conclusion? If that's the case, what does that say about your reasons or your methods if people can be using those same things and arriving at contradictory conclusions? So that's essentially what's happening there in those discussions where I'm essentially going where my conversation partner takes me. If I recall correctly in that conversation, I think I even asked her to pick her claim that we could explore, and she chose God. Mm-hmm. I didn't mention faith until she first mentioned it. So we want to try to hold back and not drive the conversation, but see where our conversation partners are taking us. But essentially, we are interested in the reliability of a method that a person is using to verify their reasons for giving a high degree of confidence that something is true. I know that's a mouthful, but that is street epistemology in a nutshell.
And so maybe in these conversations, you've planted a seed that that person's in the grocery store, you know, in a normal world, or you know, in a non-virus world, is doing whatever they're doing the next day, and they're thinking, huh, you know, I never really thought about why I believed X, Y, or Z. And by the way, it doesn't have to be God. I mean, that's just one example.
Right.
But a person might say, is the foundation, is the reason I have for believing this solid? And if it's not, can I start to peel it back? I mean, is that part of the goal here? It's not to kind of shout somebody down or mock them or tell them they're wrong.
Exactly. Street epistemology is about holding up a mirror to your own views to see if you're warranted or justified in having them or having a high degree of confidence in them. It is conceivable that I might have poor reasons for thinking something is true, and yet in reality that thing is true. So I do want to be clear on that one point. However, many, many people think that they have solid reasons for thinking that these core beliefs that are a part of their identity, they think they're on solid footing, when a few questions can tend to reveal problems with the paths that people are using to get to their conclusions. And that's the purpose of these conversations, is to encourage a person to take another look at their views every once in a while, some epistemic hygiene, so to speak, and periodically taking a look at their beliefs. And the practitioners of this method are not exempt from this as well. I often use SE on my own views. It seems to be a really great way of kicking the tires on your own beliefs, because this is important, because we act out on the beliefs that we hold. We are motivated to behave differently because of the views that we hold. And no doubt lots of people are seeing examples of this, you know, with this current situation that we're in today. But yes, SE can be used for a variety of different claims, and it seems really helpful in having a person take another look at their views and possibly even back off of their certainty because they don't have any good reasons for thinking that something is true.
How often does that happen in these videotaped sessions that you have? How often? Because what I've seen, more than people who will sort of abandon or reject a belief, I have seen some of the people you talk to say, okay, well, maybe I'm not 100%. Maybe my certainty on this belief is 50%. Maybe it's 70%, not 100%. Because people often come in and say, oh, I believe this and it's 100%. And it's you seem to have some success at showing people that, you know, 100% is pretty strong. Is there rational reason to have any doubt? But how often do you have people follow up and say, you know what, I've gone in a totally different direction?
It has happened several times, probably 36 times over the last 5 years, where people that I've spoken to have messaged me later to say, I don't believe that anymore, or I've significantly shifted in my confidence in that, or something along those lines. So it does happen. Sometimes it happens on the spot during the interview, but that's a little rare. More often than not, people, I think, and I don't track everyone that I speak to either. So I've had more than 1,000 conversations with people, but not everybody gets back to me. But it does seem, at least in the moment, that the person that I'm speaking with and asking these questions to, they are processing the conversation in a different way than they probably would have if I would have been arguing with them or giving them evidence that shows that they're mistaken. These talks tend to stay with people for years after. I'll run into people serendipitously years after the conversation, and they remember me. They remember the conversation, and they tend to come back with either better reasons for thinking that something is true, or perhaps they say, you know, I'm going to have to back off my confidence on that. I can't be so sure anymore.
So I'd like you to help me as an interviewer now, especially during this crisis, because there are some things that have surprised me in the last, especially the last week. So first of all, some listeners occasionally will say, well, you know, you don't seem objective about it. And I always say journalists are not objective because people are not objective. I'm not objective. I'm a human being with biases. I do try to be self-aware of my biases, but I'm not objective. I don't think that I've got the one true sort of prism of truth and everybody else are the one with the biases. Having said that, during a time of crisis, what I have appealed for is a... Is some kind of a standard of holding up leadership and pointing to science. And the disappointment I have in the White House is that for weeks, this is not a political claim, this is a factual claim, for weeks the President of the United States said things that were untrue and dangerous about a virus that is now killing people. It put us behind in terms of preparing. It was not honest to the American people. It was either dishonest or misinformed or ignorant. I don't know exactly. I can't get inside the president's head, but he was wrong almost every time he spoke about the virus for weeks on end. It convinced people that it was not a threat. It convinced people to still travel, to still go out to bars. And as a result, number one, we are way behind in terms of our testing capacity and our PPE and all of the equipment that we need to deal with it. And we could have been better positioned to handle it, and we're not. And number two, my concern going forward is, if the people we are trusting to lead us have not been accurate or honest, should we be able to at least talk about that and then try to turn to more reliable narrators during a crisis? Well, even during this crisis, I thought, you know, this is the one time when the followers of a political leader will abandon that person if people are literally dying. And it turns out not really. I continue to hear from listeners who tell me, you know, you don't appreciate the magnificent work the president's been doing. The media has been bashing him unfairly. He tried to warn people. All of these things that are just not, to me, demonstrably not factual and not political. Those aren't political statements. My biggest praise has been reserved for a Republican governor, and that's Mike DeWine of Ohio. So how do you grapple with this, or how would you have a conversation with someone if they were to say to you, hey, that's the guy who should be leading us through this crisis because he's been right all along. I'm so grateful for him. He's the one to listen to. What do you do with that?
Well, I'm glad that you're raising this, because there's a misperception, I think, that street epistemology is really just for talking to people about religious claims or supernatural claims. And we are using it in the political arena as well. So here's a big thing that most people, if all of your listeners can just walk away with one thing from this interview, I hope it's this. What you found compelling for dismissing the president, for example, about how he behaved in that situation, is not necessarily what somebody else will find convincing or compelling. So we spent a lot of time sharing things that we were convinced that shifted us in our views on something, and we try to pass that along to somebody hoping that it will reach them. That's the wrong way to go about doing this. It's so much more effective by engaging with somebody who might think differently about the situation regarding the president and the virus, and asking them, what is it about the president that you like? How, you know, what is he doing that you think is good? What would be an example of something that he could possibly say or do that would decrease your confidence in his performance? Now, you may
That's
find
a good
some
question.
Dogmatic...
That's a really good question. But go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. Because we make the assumption, oh, all I need to do is just give a timeline to this person that shows how inept the president was during this situation, for example. Well, if they are not fazed by timelines, or they can probably very easily come up with some reason why, well, maybe he was distracted with with the Mueller report or something along those lines. There will it's so important to talk to the person and figure out what are their inflection points when it comes to the confidence of their belief. What increases your confidence and what would decrease your confidence? Ask them to give you their roadmap and then walk through their roadmap with them. They may say, for me and the president, it's all about the economy. So as long as the stock market keeps going up, that's good enough for me. I don't care what he does. That's valuable information because you can stop wasting your time talking about other reasons that they probably won't find compelling.
So it's about confidence. So I think that's an important point here. Instead of saying, well, look at this video. This is him in late February saying that the thing was just going to vanish and that everything's fine. Shouldn't that be compelling? And you're going to pull your hair out thinking, how is this not compelling? Instead, you're asking
lucky. You may get lucky and the person says, well, you know what? That is a good, pretty good piece of information. But more often than not, especially when it's tied to a tribe that you're a part of, you probably will be wasting your time. It's so much better to ask the person what their influencing factors are and go there.
Yeah. And what's interesting is the critics of journalists like me in these moments, they love to say, well, you just bash Republicans. And the moment I point out that my biggest praise has been reserved for a Republican governor, it's on to something else. You know, what you're saying is ask them to identify what would be something that could happen that would start to diminish your confidence in this president? What's an example of something that he could do that would make you conclude that maybe he's not the great leader that you claim?
Now, a couple of points on that. Once you ask that question, pay very close attention to the answer that you receive. You may get an answer of, there's pretty much nothing that he could do that would cause me to decrease my confidence in his performance. Now, we're talking to an ideologue if that's the case, and you can start talking about other situations where they may be just as dogmatic about the behavior of a leader, for example. Sometimes you may get an answer and they may say something like, well, if I were to see this happen, then I would significantly decrease my confidence in the performance of the president. But you need to pay attention to what they're saying. They may give you an extremely high standard. For example, they may say, well, I guess if the president just stopped doing press releases and he just went silent for a month and refused to talk to the American people, then I guess that would. But they may be setting a standard so high to lower their confidence in his performance. And it's a different standard than what they're using to accept that he's doing well with his performance. And then you can have a whole different discussion about why there's a difference in their standards. Why might you have a stricter standard to decrease your confidence in his performance, but maybe you're a little bit more willing to accept anything to increase it?
And there has to be something cultural about this in that you use the word identity. People tie their political beliefs to this identity and it becomes sort of fixed. And I wonder if that's sort of a sickness that we can start to deal with, but I don't know how to do that.
This whole tribe mentality is something that we're all a part of. And I was marveling at how 3 weeks ago, maybe a month ago, a lot of the right-leaning people that I was engaging with on Twitter were extremely suspicious of the virus. And now, the second that a leader like the president admits that it's a thing, they pretty much all fell in line. We tend to just go along with what our tribe says. And I suspect it's because there's a huge cost to leaving your tribe. What would my life be like if I didn't hold to this narrative that my tribe thinks is true? My tribe is very against saying global warming is real. If I were to come out and express doubt in that, I could possibly get ostracized from my community. I'd have to look for a new one, maybe. What do I do? These are all things that I think get in the way of belief examination and belief revision.
I think we could probably start teaching epistemology earlier or really at all.
I would love to.
In the middle school level, you know, things like availability bias, confirmation bias, backfire effect, all of these things are probably things that we could teach, don't you think?
I think so. I think being aware of what our brains do when we encounter information that contradicts a pet belief that we hold to, simply being aware of what our brains are doing to maintain the belief could in and of itself be effective, I think, in helping us be more open to changing our minds. So I absolutely agree. The earlier that we can reach people by introducing them to the Socratic method and critical thinking and all those things that you that we see now with the sciences of what our brains are doing to prevent us from possibly experiencing that uncomfortable feeling of doubt. We may work, our brains may work extremely hard to avoid those feelings, and that could really get in the way of aligning our beliefs with reality as best we can.
All right, let me get our first phone call. Sam in Penfield, I'll come to you now. Listeners, Anthony Magnabosco is our guest. He is the executive director of Street Epistemology International, and he is kind of the voice inside my head telling me to take it down a notch when I get frustrated and to breathe a little. So
nice.
At least
on your shoulder there.
I try though. Sam in Penfield, first up. Go ahead, Sam.
Hi. Well, thanks for taking the call. I was listening to you say something like, you know, trying to talk to a Trump supporter, and I'll just confess, I'm more of a conservative thinker and
sure.
maybe libertarian and whatever. So I'm just putting it out on the table there. But what you had were discussing was like what asking a Trump supporter, what would it take for you to change your mind about or lose confidence in that in the president?
Sure.
And I want to turn it around and say, on the contrary, given that we've had 3 years of constant news media saying that he's a racist or that he's in Putin's pocket or that the you know, all this kind of stuff, which especially, for example, the whole Russian collusion thing has been pretty much proven false. And that has been sort of the hallmark of the news media. I'll turn it around and say, what would it take for you to finally give an honest appraisal of the president and not always be talking about how bad he is?
Okay, so can you stay on the line, Sam? Can you hang there?
For a moment.
Yeah, please hang there. I'm really glad you called, and I think the question is absolutely fair. So I'll take a first stab, and then I'll let Anthony come in. But the answer to that is, I think the president has in 3 years done some things that are worth praising, and there's a long list of things that the president could do. If the president spoke in a forthright manner about the science of climate change, I'm not even looking for policy prescriptions. I'm looking for leaders who acknowledge the science, and then we can all debate the policy. But if he says, look, I want to come up with some conservative market-based solutions, but the science is real, I'd stand up and applaud. If the president were to speak about an economy that benefits everybody, that, yes, it's great to see the Dow at 29.5, but
hasn't he been speaking about the economy up until this coronavirus sort of like gutted our economy?
Sure, sure.
Wasn't he talking every single time about the lowest black unemployment, taking the people that have been hit hardest over the last, I don't know how many years of growth, but never getting growth themselves, of finding that people of color were having more jobs and that actual wages have been climbing and things like that. That has been coming out every single time he opens his mouth. So I think that's unfair to say that what you just said about it.
Well, you are accepting the idea that this has been a marked improvement for people of color. And I suggest, first of all, talking to people of color. And second of all, there's a wide range of indicators that I would be looking for. And the wage inequality that we have in this country is an important one to me. And it hasn't moved. And by the way, it didn't get better under Obama. It got worse. Obama did a terrible job with that. So this isn't a partisan teed up point. But that is an important one to me. So those are a couple examples, but I'll let Anthony jump in.
Yeah, let me jump in there. So to be clear, I was just simply building off of the example that you used with the current president. You can use this approach for anyone, regardless of where
sure.
they stand on a political claim. In fact, it could actually be beneficial, I think, to occasionally talk to people within your own tribe and ask them how they concluded that something is true. What is your best reason? What would change your mind? And one thing I just noticed, even in that brief little exchange there, how the conversation probably could have been benefited a little bit better by being a little bit more charitable with the person's position and clarifying what position they actually have. So by saying something like, now, if I understand correctly, Evan, you would need to actually see this over time in order to increase your confidence that the president is really doing a good job. Do I understand that correct?
That's right.
And the act of Sam, for example, repeating that back to you could underscore the very thing that you said was a factor for you, and it may turn out not to be. So, but this is that exchange is what's happening all the time, and we often tend to be talking past each other, and not isolating and discussing the real reasons that are influencing our confidence. And that's something that I think street epistemology can really benefit from. In fact, we recently tabled at Politicon and CPAC before they discovered somebody there with the virus. And we are now tabling at political conventions, regardless of where we happen to be standing personally on these political issues, mm-hmm. because we want people who are interested in politics to start using this method.
Yeah, I think that's...
Yeah, and excuse me, I will just put that back at you. I appreciate the idea of putting the question back in front of somebody and said, this is how I understand what you're saying. I would just mention to you, Evan, that you suggested, and I thought that was fairly patronizing of you, suggested that I talk to people of color without knowing who I am.
That's fair. That's a fair point.
Who my friends are. And so I would suggest that you have a ways to go yourself here in this process.
I totally do, and I think you just made a good point, and I regret the comment. Okay. So
Thank you very much for admitting that.
Yeah, sure.
I really appreciate that. Okay. Thanks. I don't want to talk anymore. Let somebody else come in and have the discussion.
Sure.
But I appreciate that you're having this discussion.
Yeah, Sam, thank you very much. No, that's a fair point. I don't know your social circles, and that was probably a condescending thing that didn't build any bridges there.
Probably not. And I think there was an assumption, too, that he would find that compelling where, you know, it maybe even possibly soured the discussion.
Yeah,
so,
it's a good point.
Try to set aside our assumptions and try to be a little more charitable and ask questions to figure out what those influencers are.
Right. And Sam, one other point before I move on to other calls, and I don't want to spend the whole hour on Trump or God or whatever. We can talk about whatever people want. But one more answer for you, because, again, I've got a microphone and there's a lot of power with this. The comments that the president has made about women, his treatment of women, and the many serious allegations about his treatment of women are, if you want me to answer something that would be, that I could put in his column as something that would give me more confidence, I'd like to see him disavow all of those comments. I'd like to see him apologize and try to start making amends. That would be very, very positive. And I'd be the first to say, isn't that great? I mean, Sam, yesterday on this program, we talked about the way Gen Z is being portrayed, and that CBS News report of the kid from Ohio who went down to the beaches in Florida and said, if I get corona, I get corona. I don't care. I'm here to party and get drunk. He has come out with a really powerful mea culpa, and I don't think that young man should wear that news clip his whole life. I think he's absolutely doing the right thing now, and I love when people stand up and say they were wrong. And I was wrong during part of our conversation with you, and I'm wrong all the time. I make a sport of being wrong. That's why we got people like Anthony. So let's get our only break of the hour. Anthony Magnabosco is our guest, the executive director of Street Epistemology International, and we'll get more of your phone calls on the other side of this break. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, astrophysicist Adam Frank joins us first hour. A conversation you don't want to miss. We're going to talk about the fragility of life, the lack of guarantees, what we are learning about ourselves, even climate change in our future. Then, in our second hour, a conversation with the woman who was on the show a year ago. After she gave up plastic for Lent, has she been able to sustain that? Talk with you Thursday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Brian in Fairport, next on the phone. Go ahead, Brian.
Yeah, Evan, I'm calling because it strikes me that one of the things in this discussion that's not getting focused on, at least the parts that I've heard, is the issue of belief. Belief isn't necessarily driven by factual consideration of information that people gather from around them and logical thought. It actually suspends some of that process and is a conscious sort of process that people take to make the proverbial leap of faith. And once that leap of faith is made, logic and reason and conversation often don't have much to do with changing that belief. And I think that some of the tribalism that we see today and the political, and I'm going to call them beliefs, not ideas or thoughts or decisions that people have, are driven more by that leap of faith than by processing facts, information, and data. Just a thought to consider in the discussion.
Brian, thank you. Go ahead, Anthony.
I think that's a great point, and this is one thing that we discuss in the street epistemology community. When we ask somebody, why do you think that that's true, regardless of the claim, sometimes the reason that a person gives, well, frequently the reason that you receive from your conversation partner is not really the reason why they think it's true, because their confidence wouldn't be affected in any way if they discovered that that wasn't a good reason. So that's the first thing. The other thing is that very often, and we have a suspicion that a lot of people do this, including ourselves, we may give reasons that we just suddenly thought were good reasons for thinking that something is true, and we didn't really spend a lot of time researching it and figuring it out. We may have glanced up at the TV, we heard somebody say something, we looked at the R or the D next to their name, and then we may have just adopted the belief because it matched the tribe that we're in. And then when pressed later, why do you actually think that that's true? Our brains may be racing to come up with something that makes sense and is not necessarily the real reason why. But regardless of how we're forming these beliefs, the act of explaining how you decided that it is true can be revealing. And that is the whole impetus behind street epistemology and belief revision. When you discover, you know, the reason that I gave that guy when he was asking me questions on the trail, even as I was saying it, it just didn't ring true to me. I'm going to have to go look for a better reason to keep holding on to this belief. Even that kind of outcome is valuable, because then we can start shoring up our beliefs with really good reasons rather than ones that we may have just adopted over time.
All right, Jim in Irondequoit next. Go ahead, Jim.
Oh, boy, do I love this topic. First, I'd like to say I love the topic because it teaches people to engage peacefully. There's too much division, too much anger going on most of the time when it comes to political discussions that you can't even get beyond, you know, the simple phrases. But I'd like to tell a story about how I wound up engaging in this accidentally before I even knew there was a name for it. This is 2001, so a few months after 9/11, I had some friends who were convinced that it was an inside job, it was a conspiracy, yada, 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 and I blew it off. It bothered me to hear it. And it bothered me so much to hear it, what bothered me more was that I wasn't able to argue with them from an intelligence standpoint, from a knowledge standpoint. And so I dove into the subject, as deeply as I could. I read everything, watched everything, and absorbed everything. And I wound up being that person. It changed me. I wound up becoming a 9/11 truth person. And fast forward to the 10th anniversary of 9/11, I went to New York. And on the 10th anniversary, the street divided the quote-unquote protesters, the truth people, and the people that were going into the church there. And there was a lot of yelling going on back and forth, a lot. And it bothered me because there was nothing really being exchanged other than yelling. So what I wound up doing is going down the street, sneaking across, and getting back and getting into the crowd that was yelling at the 9/11 truth people. And anytime I saw someone yelling across, I would just nudge up to them and I would just start a conversation. I would ask questions. And it was a fascinating thing to watch how people just inevitably would walk away because they didn't want to engage, because they didn't have any knowledge. They just were basing their beliefs on what they felt, what they thought, but not that they knew. And the moment you start asking people questions, that's when you start to really get into, you know, whether someone really understands something or not. And I didn't realize there was a name for it, but it was a fascinating thing to engage in that.
All right, so Jim,
anyway, I love the topic. And
can you hang there for a sec? Can you stay there for a sec, Jim?
Sure.
All right, Anthony,
sure.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's great. And there's a lot going on when you're at a protest and you're trying to talk to somebody as opposed to maybe a friendly conversation in the Uber or on a trail or something along those lines. The venue that you're in and the energy of the moment can really sidetrack a lot of these conversations. But I think that the way that you went about doing it is, hey, let me hear these folks out. Maybe they really have a good point. Or if they haven't thought it through, perhaps I can help them take another look at their own position, and I don't even have to raise my voice. And then regarding the subject matter expertise that a lot of people think that you have to have, this is one of the nice surprises about SE or street epistemology, in that if I ran into somebody from a completely different religion or a political party, or they had some view that I've never heard of before, like antinatalism, for example, unusual topic to me, what we're finding is that you don't need to race out and familiarize yourself with the subject in order to be good at asking these questions, because the person that you're interviewing usually is the expert. So all you really need to do is get comfortable with listening, asking good questions, and giving the person plenty of time to process it. So a lot of the barriers that I think people suspect are in the way to be good at this are not really there. Your biggest hurdle at being good at SE is setting aside your bias. And it sounds like that's what Brian did there. I'm sorry, Jim.
Jim.
Was he set aside his views, he walked over there, and he started asking questions. And that's incredible. We need more people to start doing that. Because if Jim is mistaken, I would imagine he would want to stop being mistaken. If that protester was mistaken, they might want to start believing true things too. Now, there's peer pressure, and you're surrounded by a lot of people, and there might be pressure to toe the line. But the way that you went about doing that was fantastic.
Now, and Jim, are you still – you think 9/11 was an inside job?
Oh, 100%, 100%. And I can tell you that the reactions that I got that day continue to this day. I go to New York every year on the anniversary, and every year it's crazy how predictable people are when they're walking by that will yell at you, but they're the least likely to engage. And I was brought to tears last year when in the middle of this big city of learned people and adults, An 11-year-old boy just come up and start reading all the placards that were laid out for people to read. And his parents, I don't know where he was from. He looked like he was from the Midwest, somewhere in the sticks. And he dragged his parents over there, this 11-year-old boy, and was just reading and would turn and tell them what he was reading, turn back around and keep reading. And I sat there watching him, and I thought to myself, this 11-year-old kid, this precocious boy, has more understanding of how to approach the world than all these adults in this big city walking by,
all right, but
yelling things.
But Jim, let me, you just said 100%. You're 100% convinced 9/11 was an inside job.
Yeah, I am.
What's something that could decrease your 100%? What could make you 90%? What's something that would make you
hear it? I'm waiting to hear it. I've been waiting for 15 years, and you'll get the same answer from everyone that thinks like me.
Well, that's not really an answer, though, is it? I'm trying to alight upon something that you can identify that would help you or that would make you decide that maybe this 100% shouldn't be 100%.
Well, you're assuming that I haven't arrived at that 100% based on evidence. And when you reach a point, it's just like any crime. You study a crime and you study the evidence, circumstantial evidence, forensic evidence, all the evidence that exists. And when you study it and you stand back and you decide whether you can reach a solid conclusion or not, can you say with 100% certainty? And I can tell you right now, yes. I've spent 15 years immersed in the subject, and I was someone that truly believed what everyone else believes, essentially, you know, that we were attacked by an ant, you know, the whole official story.
But it doesn't sound like there's anything now. It doesn't sound like there's anything now. So, Anthony, what would you say in this point?
Well, what I would do is it sounds like Jim has some evidence to back up his claim that 9/11 was an inside job. I would take him for his word that he has evidence. I am a little – it caught my attention when it was mentioned that, well, nothing would change my mind. But if you are arriving at your conclusion from evidence, I would suspect that if we discovered that your evidence isn't as good as you think that it is, that it would lower your confidence in this view. Is that a fair statement?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay.
Yep.
So if we were to look at your top three reasons and you discovered that all three of those aren't good reasons anymore, for one reason or the other, they're not as good as maybe you suspected, would it lower your confidence from your 100?
Of course.
Okay, good. Excellent. Thank you. I'm relieved to hear that. I'm not surprised because you're walking up to people and you're engaging with them. That kind of openness is really good. If I had a conversation partner who said, I'm stubbornly sure that this is real and nothing will change my mind, then we have other questions to start asking. But this is a good indication that if we were to walk through your reasons and if you were to discover to your satisfaction that they weren't good, that it would indeed impact your confidence in your conclusion, then I think we could have a conversation and we can explore those.
Jim, thank you. And maybe that's more of a conversation as well for a different day. Let me get Nalong and Pen Yan. Go ahead.
Hello, Evan. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Thanks.
I'm just kind of amazed at the anti-factualism of some of these, of this recent radio, this conversation. And
what do you mean?
It's baffling me.
Well, help me understand what you mean.
Well, the anti-truther that was just on the phone, for one thing. Some of the libertarian that was on here that wasn't stating any sources for his statements that he was making. And I do try to understand the other side quite a bit. I try to read the Nation newspaper, and it just seems kind of ridiculous at times. And it might be my implicit bias, but I do try to listen. But what trumps everything else is the facts with fracking.
I guess I'm confused as to where you think that we are not interested in facts.
Well, no. I totally get the facts, but sometimes on the other side of the aisle, so to speak, the facts are kind of irrelevant.
I could speak to this a little bit.
Yeah, go ahead, Anthony.
One thing that we find is that most people will respond to facts when they're ready to take them. And street epistemology is really good for assessing where a person is. You may be lucky and run into somebody who is ready for the facts that shows that Donald Trump didn't respond quickly enough to the coronavirus, for example. But I would really urge people, yes, of course, facts are important, but giving people facts when they're not ready for them can make the situation worse. So it's far more important we're finding to use questions to figure out where a person is. For example, the fellow prior to, I think his name was Jim, with the 9/11 truther stuff, that's giving him facts that we think he'll find convincing will likely not work. We need to find out what he's found convincing and go from there. And then when he is ready for the facts that shows that he's wrong, we can provide them to him, for example. So I can see how there might be a perception, like I'm thinking that maybe Milana's calling by thinking, well, I'm not noticing any pushback. Why aren't you giving him facts? Why aren't you showing people that they're wrong? What are you doing? Why are you allowing this injustice to stand? And we do understand that at some point you have to give facts, but if a person's not ready for it, you can make the situation worse for them.
Yeah, Nalong, to be clear here, my goal is to explore the most effective ways to allow people to examine their own beliefs. And me too, by the way. This isn't just an exercise in which, hey, you want to win an argument and prove someone wrong. This is how do we build a society in which we are examining the validity or the reliability of our claims. And we are examining and re-examining and taking fresh looks and being humble. And that is a challenge. And it's a challenge for me. And I don't do it nearly well enough. That's one of the reasons I wanted Anthony here. I don't do it nearly well enough. And I hope you'll come back sometime, Anthony. Why don't you close in our last minute or so by letting our audience know more about maybe what you're working on or what you'd like them to kind of check out and think about here.
Well, Street, thank you again for having me on. I love talking about this. It's something that I've been doing for 8 years now, and it's gaining momentum. We have people from around the world who are learning this, regardless of where they stand. So regardless of where you stand on God or the president or 9/11, you can learn this tool and engage with people on it. And ultimately, we think the more people who learn this, the better it will be for getting to the actual truth of the matter. And that's something that I think we're all looking for.
And 30 seconds, try to squeeze this in here. Don wants to know, is there anything special in how street epistemology tackles values? Aren't some values just accepted as self-evident? Is that allowed, or can all values be reduced down to something like their effect on human well-being?
This is a new area that we're getting into, this idea of lots of people thinking that I'm a good person because I happen to hold a particular view, and helping people realize that they can still be good people and shift their perspectives of conclusions is a really crucial part of this.
I hope you'll come back sometime, Anthony, and I'm really grateful for your work. And like I said here, I don't always sort of keep a good, sort of the right mind frame in hosting this program, because it's a big responsibility and I take it seriously. But your work is sort of reinforcing for me as to the important approach to explore with people and not just sort of lob fact bombs, etc. I mean, it's a long process, and you're helping me get better. Thanks for doing it.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for having me on, Evan.
And where online, by the way, Anthony Magnabosco, where to find you?
Twitter at Magnabosco, or search for Street Epistemology Anthony on YouTube, and you will find hundreds of videos of people using SE.
All right. Anthony Magnabosco, our guest for this hour. Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer. Megan Mack is the producer. MRA Stein is the intern. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon. We'll talk to you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.